it's a cakewalk for the good old Collingwood.
Well, if we played relevant club songs to Mick Irwin's football journey, that would just about be the program, whether it would be Collingwood or Richmond club songs, whether it would be the club songs of Port Melbourne, Coburg or Paran, who all profited handsomely for the influence of Mick Irwin. We could turn it into a music show, but we would rather speak to the man himself. Good evening, Mick.
Good evening, Jeff.
Jeffrey, say good evening to Mick.
How are you, Mick?
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
I saw you on Friday and you looked in pretty good, Nick.
Yeah,
for a man with your vast experience.
Yes, I was in very good nick last Friday at the Emerald.
That's a good place. It's a good kicking off point for weekends, isn't it? I've seen Jeffrey there on a Friday afternoon, and I've got the notion pretty much that the work week's over when he's there on a Friday, Mick.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, we had the VFL luncheon, which was great, and Jeff was there, and a virtually forgotten legend. So a really good catch-up day.
Mick, the football journey that we're about to embark on wends its way from the VFL, the then VFL, or as we now know it, AFL, but we'll just call it league football, into the association. But I'd love to get your take on what the association, not as much as what it's become, because we know it's a many things to many different clubs, but just to give our listeners an idea of exactly how powerful a competition it was in the 70s and how important it was to Melburnians, because Saturday was VFL, Sunday was VFA, and there were occasions when more of the crowds went on a Sunday than they did on a Saturday.
Yeah, well, we're very lucky. As you know, I played with Collingwood and Richmond and ended up getting a job as captain and coach of Coburg. And I was actually at a Port Melbourne reunion on Sunday and talking to Gary Bryce and a few of the guys there, Arms and that. And we all just said how lucky we were to be involved in that era after coming away from our VFL as it was then and just being able to still maintain a high level of standard of football with the crowds and the quality of play. So very, very important. I'll just give you a bit of an idea. When I was coaching Paran in 78, we won the flag. Well, Rossy Thornton was playing. He'd been rejected by Fitzroy. He played in their under-19s, and then they delisted him. And Wayne Johnson had been rejected twice by Carlton. So that gave those guys, a chance to stay at a certain level. And of course, we know the Dominator became, one of the greatest half-board flankers of all time. And Rossy Thornton ended up going back and captaining Fitzroy. I wonder if that vehicle wasn't there, that would have ever happened. So I think that gives you a bit of an idea of how important it was. And I'm sure there's a few other stories the same.
Spot on. The clubs that you had major influence at, and I mean major, at Coburg, captain and coach of the 70 Division 2 Premiership team, of course, yep. A member of the Port Melbourne 74 Premiership side, and then a coach of that magnificent Paran 78 Premiership side, as much as you would be a key invitee and I'm sure a key attendee of reunions and the such, when talk gets on to how much they hated the opposition, because rivalries were spawned out of that great era. It'd be funny, Mick, they'd be talking about, great to have Mick Irwin here, and didn't we hate Port? Oh, hang on, you played for Port, or didn't we hate... I don't know how they allow you into some of those nights.
Yeah, well, that's because I was a good bloke, mate. neither do I. I'll tell you, when I went to Port from Coburg, that rivalry was definitely there, because I went the whole pre-season without any of the actual Port players talking to me. So it was fortunately Darryl Herrod and Ian Owen and Tony Hayne, a couple of those came in the same year as me, and Normie Brown was his first year of coaching. I grew up with Normie, so they were the only ones that spoke to me. So, that reiterates your point.
And you did something that I would almost call reckless to the point of self-harm, and that is having coached a young Trevor Price, then seen what Trevor developed into, to leave the club that you played with him for and head to another club that he hated, to lock horns against him on the field, was tantamount to suicide.
Yeah, well, it was pretty easy because they were in second division. That's why I left them. I didn't actually get to play against him.
Oh, thank goodness.
I probably would have in 85. But, yeah, Trevor was... actually, I was once again at another reunion the other week at Coburg. I'm on the board at Coburg now as well. But he was saying to me that it was my fault that he became that rough. And I said, how do you explain that? And he said, oh, well, you know, I went after the ball one day and I let a bloke get past me and you came over and said to me, you know, and you never let that happen again or you won't be playing here and blah, blah. And I said, well, that didn't give you a license to whack blokes. You
know? Well, he just said he took that out every single week he played. That was great.
Oh, you better believe it, yeah. Yes, and he certainly, in one of the grand finals, demonstrated that against Geelong West.
Mick, you played at Collingwood under-19s. What footy did you play before that? And I remember you as a pretty capable key position player, solid, tough player. And the other point leading on to that is you should have played more games at Collingwood, but for some reason I remember you had a lot of similar types of players. And I said the same thing about I was talking to Bronco Johnson about a bloke called Robert Farmer. I remember he should have played more games, shouldn't he? They didn't seem to want to play more than a couple of the same types. You know, in those days, if you couldn't play centre forward or half forward flank, they didn't put you anywhere else, did they? You're either in or out, weren't you?
Yeah, well, I played with West Tyler with YCW. Actually, was a centreman, and when I in my junior footy, but I grew probably 6 inches in 1 year, and then I became centre half back at Collingwood under-19s, and then I played my first game with Collingwood at fullback. I think it was more the fact that I was in the state squad in 62, but I didn't make the team, just the squad. Mm. But yeah, next year I had a back injury starting in the year. Bobby Rose came to the team and he didn't really like the way I played much, as simple as that, you know. So I went to Richmond.
Too rugged or what?
It was nothing personal or whatever. I just think sometimes, particularly in those days, coaches typed you, you know.
Yeah. But don't
and
you,
he did, put me a full forward and sent half forward and I did all right there and whatever. Yeah. And then
you
drop into one of those categories where if the team gets beaten, there's usually two or three of the same blokes get dropped.
Got blamed, yeah.
I noticed that Ben Kennedy at Collingwood's copping a bit of that now, but he's only young, you know.
Yeah. But did you think that did you agree with my theory that in those days, if you're a certain type, if there was you had a competitor for a position and you just missed out, then, you know, they typecast you at a certain sort of player and they didn't try somewhere else?
Yep, absolutely. Mm.
Isn't it interesting, Mick? You said you were a centreman in your younger days, then grew 6 centimetres and became a key position player, yet today you're probably 6 centimetres short of the new midfielder.
Exactly right. Well, you know, I'm 6'1" and I think I might be 6'1" now, but yeah, you look at Chris Judd, what's he, 6'4", and Pendlebury's around that height, so it's just amazing, absolutely amazing that they can be that tall and that skillful. Yeah,
and the move to Richmond, Mick. Did you initiate that, or you said that you didn't get on all that well with Rose, or Rose didn't appreciate the way you played. But
I was playing full forward at Collingwood at the time, and Graham Richmond rang me up, and they were looking for a full forward, and in the middle of 65, just before the clearances closed. So I went to Richmond and I trained on the Thursday night and I was in this team on the Saturday, which was quite daunting. I averaged 3 goals a game.
Well, it was a great move.
People laugh at me and they say, you won the goal kicking at Richmond, but you only kicked, I think it was 36 goals, you know. Mm. So you want to look at it, I only played 12 bloody games, you know.
Yeah.
It was a great move. I'm not sure how much time you spent at full forward at Collingwood, but there wasn't a great haul of goals. And as soon as you turn up at Richmond, you play against North Melbourne round 7, having been there for 48 hours. And in consecutive weeks, 3-3, 3-3, 3-3, 4-2, then a blank 4-5 and 3 goals as the team doesn't miss the finals by a heck of a lot.
No.
And had they entered those finals, you would have been in pretty peak form. I mean, that was a really successful move. Did you feel that you flourished at Richmond for any particular reason? Because it looked like the perfect fit.
Yeah, well, they I mean, it was made a bit harder when Tommy came and they just kicked the ball longer. But still, you know, you had good players in front of you like Royce Hart and those guys and Billy Brown. And I just felt freer. I just felt freer. I didn't feel under the pressure that, I don't know what it was that developed in Collingwood. I lost a lot of confidence in myself. And to get me across in the middle of the season and put me straight in, the players made me welcome. And to be honest, I enjoyed my playing days at Richmond far better than I did at Collingwood.
Ganane was a centre-half forward for most of his career.
Yeah, Billy Barrett in the middle, yeah, you know, Dickie Clay.
With Ganane, did he, I mean, look, towards the end of his career, did he get pushed from centre-half forward to full forward because he got a bit slower and therefore anybody else who wanted to play full forward sort of misses the boat?
Yeah, well, he actually went to the forward pocket.
Forward pocket, yeah.
And then, you know, 2 years down the track, they put me back to full back. I actually think my best position was centre-half back. That's where I played in the under-19s.
Yeah.
And played in the Victorian side in the under-19s. I don't know, but it might have been under-18 then, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I never really got to play there. I remember the assistant coach at Johnny Nixley at Richmond felt that and tried to talk me into, you know, to staying and not going to Coburg, but I'd had enough by that stage. So at 26 years of age, I was finished at Lake Footy, and you look back on that and think, well, that was turning it up a bit easy, but that was where I was at personally, you know. Mm. Now, given those, you're talking about the goals, and then if you look at the grounds that we played on and the weather compared to what they play in now, even if you average three a game now, you kick 66 goals, you know.
Yeah. Oh, no question about that. The grounds were terrible in a lot of games, weren't they?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You go out to, even the Richmond ground, the Punt Road, when I was there, we played the our home ground was the MCG, but... You know, Western Oval and Fitzroy and those places were just quagmires, you know.
You leave 1965 as Tigers' number one goal kicker. The team looks in good nick, but 1966 appears to not be kind to you, and it, I imagine, was injury that kept you off the field for almost two-thirds of the season, if not three-quarters.
Yeah, I did a cartilage in a training. And in those days, actually, I think I came back after 14 weeks, but they were massive operations in those days.
Mm.
I think there's only one guy who missed less games than me. I'm not talking in the seniors. A bloke by the name of Crowe that played an half-back flank for Fitzroy. I think he holds a record in that era of missing 30 games, you know, 13 weeks before he came back. So by the time you come back halfway through the season, you've got to get... You know, you've got to get them, work your way back, get your confidence and work your way back into the reserves, into the seniors. The season's over. I actually played in the reserves premiership side that year.
Because some of the great players had knee injuries and they weren't actually, like today, it's ACLs and that sort of stuff. They were just bad cartilages, weren't they? They put them out for... Sometimes they didn't ever get back, you know?
A lot of them didn't ever play again. And probably had more damage than the cartilages, but they were a season thing. They'd take your cartilage out. You had a massive scar in your leg and you had your leg in plaster for 3 or 4 weeks. A lot of rehabilitation from that. But I did a massive amount of work before I went to hospital, so that helped.
We're chatting with Mick Irwin. And Mick, something did happen in 1966, even though you didn't play a heck of a lot of football. And I wonder whether it's cost you wonderful food, wine and coffee ever since, because I think you were minorly, but importantly, involved in the day that Paddy Ganane ran through Frank Dimatina. And I think, according to Frank, you might have deflected Paddy into him.
No, really. We were both, Paddy came in from the side and Frankie was running back. You know, the ball was dropping and he just went back. It was a suicide-type mark and proof, Frankie's absolute courage. He's a very courageous rover. I'm pretty sure he hit Paddy's knees. It was right alongside me. I'm not sure whether I deflected Paddy, but it was certainly there, and the crack that went Frankie's head hit Paddy's knees or around that area was sickening.
He's a great fellow, Frank, and he said...
He's a lovely man.
Yeah, and he said it was never quite the same again after that.
No, he wasn't. His pace and everything was not the same, and one would understand why, you know.
With much to talk about from the time you turned up to Coburg, we'll leave the VFL in a moment, not before 1967, when I... Was it injury or form? Because it appeared as though you were having a good season... And halfway through the season, 13 or 14 games into the season, you didn't play for 4 or 5 weeks, appeared once again, and that was it in a premiership year. And I'm just wondering whether it was cruel luck again, because I would like to imagine that Mick Irwin probably had a spot in that very good team for most of the year reason.
I actually came fourth or fifth in the best and fairest that year. I tore a quad muscle.
So,
and then I tried to come back, and they, look, they're a 13. Even now they're a 10 or 13, and I really ripped it, and it was a shocker. And then I came back, and it went again. So I think a couple of weeks before the final. So,
yeah, that's right.
So that was it. I was absolutely pleased to see the boys win, but I can still vividly remember Crowe and I sitting in the. Sitting in the grandstand, Crowe was, worse than me from a point of view that he got that, ridiculous suspension for slapping John Nicholls, and I was out with the quad, and both of us, certainly never would have been, arguably I would have been in the side. So that was pretty disappointing, great for him to win, but disappointing to miss the finals and miss actually playing in a premiership side, even though you feel you played a fairly big part in it,
Well, this story of a very good footballer with rotten luck is getting worse and worse. So I think we need to take a break and need to change tack. And we're going to do that. We're going to send Mick to the VFA, where he becomes a champion player, a champion coach, and that premiership that cruelly eluded him in '67 certainly doesn't elude him at his next three clubs. After the break, Mick Irwin, the VFA legend, is exposed.
Well, there's been sensations galore here in this final. Big Sam down there, the peacemaker. And McGuinness is being taken off the ground, I think, by his runner.
Well, there you go. Highlights from the 1978 VFA Grand Final. And you couldn't win a Grand Final in the VFA in the 70s without spilling a bit of blood. And the coach of Paran that day, Mick Irwin, would have been a little bemused that the peacemaker they were talking about was Sam Kekovic. Mick, you played in the 74 Grand Final for Port Melbourne, and that was a day where blood was spilt. Paran did it in 78, and I don't know about the 70 Grand Final with Coburg in Division 2, but I imagine it wasn't a walk in the park.
No, we played Box Hill, ironically. It's probably the hardest. It's the hardest games that I've coached in second division. The other day, as I said, we had a reunion, and I quickly looked through all the scores for the year of 1970. I think we won, 10 games by 15 goals, we belted Sunshine both times during the year, and we belted them by 11 goals in the second semi. Box Hill, the only team to beat us, and they beat us twice during the year. And thank God, Box Hill beat Sunshine in the preliminary final, because I was really thinking to myself, how am I going to get these guys up after they've won by 10 goals and 12 goals and 13 goals against the side we're playing in the grand final? As we know, footy can be a funny game. You can have one of those days out. And it's going to cost you a flag, as did happen the year before.
See, that's really interesting, Mick. And that's the psychology of a coach, that you were thankful that Box Hill, the team that had bested you twice, won that game. And as the coach, worried about how you would motivate the side against the Crows of Sunshine because of the reasons you just laid before us there. And that sort of coaching thinking, it's a little bit different to how most people would think, Mick.
Man, you think, I don't know. All I can remember is being at the game and saying to the boys after, thank God they won, And, you know, apart from what I've just said, you know, we wanted another crack at them. They were the only team to beat us, so the players didn't need a lot of motivation. They said, well, they won't get us this time, Big Mick, you know. And
well, they may have said, you know, well, you won the premiership, but you didn't beat us. So that was conclusive, wasn't it?
As well, yeah. Yeah. We wanted a crack at them, and it was a credit to them getting through because it was a late run from them. But we beat them by 5 goals. So.
I remember the 74 grand final, Mick, and it was a pretty tough game, and I don't think there's ever been a tougher Port Melbourne outfit. And the other team had two...
Oakley,
yeah, had brothers. I know two or three brothers that were pretty rugged and a few other rugged blokes. So it was a pretty rugged game, wasn't it?
Yeah, Tommy Quinn and the boys, yeah. That was a pretty rugged game. In actual fact, the fight started in the middle of the ground, you know, the Port boys, like, they love a fight and they didn't let anybody down. In the end, to break up the fight, in those days they had the mounted police, you know, and they, you know, the two of them just rode the horses through the players. I soon jumped out of the road of that one, but yeah, she was pretty rugged. It sort of, I think Tommy Quinn had gone through, jumped early in the game and dropped his knees into his back and injured his lungs. He had to be carried off.
Yeah.
So, but we won that quite easy as well. You know, and it was just a great to be there. My first year there, and having had the flag at Coburg, and as you said, the disappointments in the other. In the other era, it was just lovely to be there, and it was a great day.
You mentioned, well, Poults mentioned there were tough players, Halliday, Quinn for Oakley, the Lilies, and
Harland, and
for Port Melbourne,
Prophet,
might throw to Mick Irwin.
Allen was pretty good.
Yeah, George Allen, my word. Who were some of the enforcers, Mick, that meant that somebody like Quinn might have got away with it once, but he was never going to get away with it twice?
Yeah, look, you know, Georgie Allen, and you know, Malcolm Allen was the toughest of them all. You know, he didn't run around, you know, for his toughness, but he was tough and wasn't all that smart at times. He'd whack bucks whether the umpire was there or not, you know. And you had Buster Harlan, who probably thought he was tough, but he was, yeah, at times he was. And, you know, some really good hard players at that stage. Sammy Holt was the toughest sort of half forward flanker, you know, in equal with Wayne Johnson in a different way that I've ever seen in VFA footy. And Cookie himself was just, wasn't a real enforcer, but my God, he was a really tough guy who I really admired from the point of view that no matter how they whacked him or whatever, he never lost his cool, unlike me.
He kicked 10 goals in that grand final.
Yep.
And the crowds for those final series, it actually was a VFA record, I believe, but just shy of 24,000. At the old St Kilda Cricket Ground, the Junction Street Oval, Junction Oval, enormous crowds. And
at the 78 Grand Final, 31,000 against Preston.
To call them halcyon days would not even do them justice. I think it's best summed up with a stat that I sort of reel out when talking of those days. And in around that time, 74, Geelong were not a brilliant team in the VFL. And there was a weekend where Geelong drew about 12,500 to Cardinia Park, and Geelong West outdrew them by 3,000 or 4,000 people for a home and away game at the old Velodrome. It's hard to imagine, but
that might have been the day that Port played them.
Yeah, that's right. It was versus Port.
Yeah.
And it was made up in no small part because of personalities, people like Fred Cook or Joe Radojevic. There were shows within shows, weren't there?
Yeah, well, I think the good part about it, there's probably four or five in every side, particularly the top sides, that weren't long out of VFL footy, you know. And you had your Sam Kekoviches, your Stretch Andersons and all those that had been very, very good senior players, you know, at the top level. I mean, just to give you an instance, I coached the VFA interstate side for 4 years. 3 years. And when you got down to picking 20 VFA, the top VFA players, like we went to South Australia and they beat us by 11 points. Mm. And 14 of those players next year played, you know, VFL footy. You had Greg Phillips and all those sort of guys playing. Mm. And we belted Tasmania and Queensland. So when you got down to it, and you picked out your top 20 players, you weren't far away from being a really good side. The difference being that those 20 players probably would lack the consistency you needed to be, you know, really, really top VFL players. But if they had their day, like they did a couple of times, luckily for me, the sides were pretty impressive.
Names like Cook and Radojcevic are easily remembered. I guess the nature of being a Smith makes it easy for people to forget. But you played with two great Smiths at full forward, I reckon. I'm pretty sure you would have played with Peter Smith. I think you might have, and certainly you coached...
No, I didn't. Peter Smith, we came from Port Melbourne. That was the swap. I went to Port.
Oh, okay.
Coburg, yeah.
He's a good player, yeah. Peter Smith.
But I had... you talk about top full forward. I had...
Kim Smith
of Perrin. Yeah. Kim's passed away, as you
Which
probably know.
Very sad. Now, he was...
He was a wonderful player. He kicked in the year... In 78, he kicked seven. I think he kicked 97 or 98 goals that year. He just didn't quite make it, you know. But he was a wonderful player and a great leader. He was a vice captain. He was a great leader and a great man.
I was bemused by, now I don't know whether he did this all his career, but I wasn't used to full forwards with beards, and he had a beard at one stage.
Oh, mate, he had everything. When I went there, he had long hair, he had a beard, he had a wrangled moustache. Yeah. He wouldn't play in front. He thought he was, you know, he thought he didn't have to play in front. He could just jump on blokes. So,
well, I was a Caulfield supporter.
Smithy and I had to have a bit of lunch, and he had to find out what he needed to do if he wanted to keep getting the game. And fortunately, he listened. We became very good friends after that.
I was a Caulfield supporter and a very cheeky boy, and I went to Turek Park one week and suggested to our full back, a guy called Hook, not to get too close to Smith because you'd get fleas off him. And boy, did he give me a dirty look, Kim Smith. If there wasn't a fence, he would have jumped it and clocked me.
Yeah, yeah. I think he would have been pretty safe. His look's about as far as he went with that sort of thing.
And Mick,
it was a good look, wasn't it?
It was a good look.
You had to have that. Mick, you're assistant coach to Barry Richardson at Richmond, and later you're assistant coach to Tommy, and you took over from Tommy when Tommy got the sack after 10 games of 82. Did you develop a rapport with Tommy when you were at Richmond? I mean, were you good mates of his, or how did it come about that you went to Collingwood?
Not at all.
No. So you got that independently, did you?
Richmond as a player, there's no problem. You know, Tommy was great.
Yeah.
But as assistant coach, well, I was assistant coach to Barry because that's when they moved him on to Collingwood. Or he moved Tommy on and he went to Collingwood. So had no association with him there. And then when I was assistant coach, he wanted Kevin Morris for the coaching job, and I got it. So all I did was move witches hats around while I was assistant coach.
And when you took over, you rejuvenated Peter Dacos. You put him in the centre and he was getting 30 plus. And also, still kicking goals.
He won his first Copa in that year.
Yeah.
And he got most of his votes in those last 12 games. Not all of them.
Yeah, it was a wonderful move. And had you thought that all along, that he would be better placed nearer the footy?
Yep, absolutely. I just felt that he's... Peter, as I've said to many guys, Peter was the sort of player that, he received 0.05 times a game, so he always got the ball himself. And I was trying to get him into the middle where he could maybe run past a few players and whatever and pick up some, not easy kicks, but, you know, kicks where he could do some damage. And so I sort of put him in the middle and said to the backline guys, I don't care if he's got three blokes on him, just kick it to where he is. Oh. And it worked, and it worked for us in short term. Then we got hit with horrific injuries and, you know, we struggled to put games together until the last game of the year we were beat Geelong down at Geelong.
Was your first game as coach against St Kilda?
Yep.
Yeah, I remember it. Of course, because it was a nice...
Both of those pretty easy.
Yeah, it was a nice big win. And you had some enigmatic players. That day, Rene Kink tore St Kilda apart. If he would have kicked straight, I reckon we would have lost by 200 points.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been hard to keep a leash on Rene, but boy, there was some ability there.
Yeah, we were very hard. He ended up not playing in the seniors. He thought he could train and do when he wanted to, so we sort of sorted that out. And he played in the... Played in the in the twos for the rest of the year, because I just to protect myself, I told the rest of the players that while Rene Kick was the way where he was, he would never play in the seniors at Collingwood while I was coach. You know, I did that on purpose, so I couldn't go back on it.
Another player that I thought really flourished under yourself was Tony Shaw, and did you see him as the man to captain the side to their first premiership all those years later?
No, not at all. To be honest, I actually during the year, and this could be letting things out of school, but Tommy had typed Tony and said, "Well, he won't be here at the end of the year." And when Tommy went, Tony was in the reserves, and you know, he was just a goer, and you know, we just needed him in the seniors. His energy and his fitness and his determination and his skill level wasn't as high as it could have been at the time, but Tony was also a sort of player that was, we saw from that went on that that developed his skill level to relate it to his ability. But I know I didn't think he'd go on and be the great player that he was, but he certainly, I always thought he was a senior player that fitted a particular mould that I always liked, because I just believe team balance is very important. You're going to have too many receivers and too many blokes that go in and get the ball and not enough finishers. So there's a bit of a real challenge of a balance for a coach and a selection committee to put the team together. But Tony Shaw to me is a perfect example of the epitome of someone maximising everything that God gave them when their parents gave them.
And what a perfect stepping off point from a great chat, Mick, because your career, as I said, whether it was at Collingwood, Richmond, where you would, and of course alluded to by Jeff Poulter, work with Barry Richardson in a coaching capacity, the Paran, Coburg, Port Melbourne, highly valued, and no surprise that you saw in Tony Shaw those values that you, of course, exhibited as player and coach. It's a great way to end a chat that I absolutely loved, and I know the listeners did as well, because we've got SMSs from all different VFA supporters, and that means that they certainly love those memories going back to those great days. Can't thank you enough, Mick.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Mick.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks, guys, and have a good night.